It's the morning show on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent today and tomorrow. In a quest for health and beauty and energy, humans have long tried a variety of treatments to cure what ailed them. These included arsenic for skin problems, heroin as a cure for morphine addiction, and bloodletting for a broken heart. Well, today we're going to hear from Nate Peterson, who is an Oregon-based librarian, historian, and freelance journalist. He's also, more importantly, the co-author of a new book titled Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. This hour in the morning show, we'll talk about the wacky things we've done historically to try to improve our health. So, for the listeners, how has medicine and drugs changed over your lifetime? What are some of the things that you've seen? Maybe when you were a youth or something that's no longer done, that seems kind of wacky when we look at it in retrospect. What treatments do you remember from childhood that wouldn't be used today? And what parts of medical history fascinate you? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also reach us via email, ideas@WPR.org, or you can post to the Ideas Network Facebook page and tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest, Nate Peterson. Nate, thanks for joining us this morning. Let's first dig into the idea of quackery. When you use that term, what do you mean by it, particularly when it comes to medicine?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on the radio in Wisconsin. I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, so it's a place near and dear to my heart.
Go Bucky!
Exactly, yep. So quackery, the way that we defined it in the book that I co-wrote with Dr. Lydia King is that we expanded it a little bit beyond the typical definition of quackery, which is when someone's intentionally selling something to you that they know doesn't work. So we also included examples of times in medical history where people were pushing the boundaries or maybe going against current scientific or medical thinking and trying to expand or embrace a new direction or embrace a new element or new discovery, like a new plant discovery. So we took a little bit broader view of quackery in the book.
So quackery then wouldn't always be a bad thing.
Exactly, right. It can sometimes just be a stopping place on the way, you know, toward something that's actually good or actually useful to our people today.
Could you give an example of some benefits of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So a good example would be leeches. You know, so there was a period in time where leeches were all the rage. People were quite proud of bearing leech marks, which if you can picture it in your head, it looks like the Mercedes-Benz logo. That's what a leech bite looks like on your skin. And people were quite proud of those for a while when leeching was sort of all the rage. But what folks were hoping to do by using leeches was to take out the bad blood, the quote-unquote bad blood in their system. It was based on an antiquated view of how the blood works, which is that anything that ailed you could potentially be the result of quote-unquote bad blood in your system. So you needed to let that blood out of your system in order to improve your health, leeches being a great tool to do that. That thought eventually was set aside as medical thinking progressed, but leeches, as it turns out, have some very useful medical properties to them. And in the saliva of a leech is a medical property that's an anticoagulant that is still used today. It's manufactured synthetically, so we don't use leeches as commonly in the ER room and so on, but the properties of that leech saliva are actually quite useful.
I'm trying to imagine sitting in my doctor's office and having the doctor reach into a drawer and pull out a bucket of something that in this part of the world we would call bait,
right.
And say, "Here, I'm going to stick a couple of these on you. We'll have you out of here in a minute." You know, we probably wouldn't respond to that too well. Quackery. Is this something that's kind of been banished to the basement of history, or do we still see examples of it today?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and of course, the million-dollar question at any given time is, what will people think of as quackery in 100 years? You know, like, what are we embracing right now, or what do we even think right now is actually really good for us that turns out to be really bad? So that's always interesting to me, to kind of take a step back and try to have a little bit of a critical eye, even about currently accepted consensus and things, because, you know, it all changes, right? Everything grows and develops over time.
And it probably won't take 100 years. I mean, we have these kind of waves of the new miracle cure for just about everything from acne to relationships. And they're here today, and then a year later, somebody comes out with another study and say, oh, wait a minute, if you take this stuff, it'll kill you. You know, instead of, I don't know, making your hair grow or whatever it was supposed to do, there's sort of a compression of time that's taking place as technology evolves ever more rapidly. You write about the drive to be healthy, to be young, to be beautiful, to be energetic. We all would love those things. How have these desires driven the way we treat illness and other health problems?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I think the part that I find really interesting looking back in history, so, you know, you might be tempted to sort of take a superior viewpoint and kind of laugh at our forebears. But, you know, we all had that same desire, right? Everyone throughout history has wanted to live longer and to be healthier while they were doing it and to have as long a life as possible. And so that means we're willing to try all manner of crazy and interesting things. And that desire to live can be kind of inspiring, really. And so I always kind of laugh when I look back at some of these really seemingly absurd or ridiculous cures, because, you know, if you put yourself into that mindset of that time and place, at least for me anyway, it's not too hard to imagine myself lining up, you know, to get my leech and, you know, et cetera. So.
Well, I mean, these were commonly accepted. This is, you know, physicians said this worked, and people had, they didn't know any better. And new discoveries would be made, and oh my goodness, you know, this morphine, this is magic stuff. Let's give it to everybody.
Exactly.
You know, and we've seen this with other things. And now, of course, now we have the internet, which isn't always, let's face it, exactly the gold standard of accurate health information. How does that factor into this discussion we're having about quackery, do you think?
Sure, that's a great example too. So Dr. Google, as you may be familiar with, right? So
yes.
I think everyone, you know, possibly listening to the program, myself certainly included, you know, turned to Google various times to check out what you have going on with you, right? And to kind of figure out if you can self-diagnose. You know, it's an interesting thing. Google's been great for disseminating information. You know, the internet's awesome for that. But of course, the negative side of that is that it can also disseminate bad information or faulty information. And that's the problem, is you have to learn how to review the things you find online with a bit of a critical eye. It's always good, of course, to check in on some medical procedure that you find online, you know, before you just embrace that, to check in with your physician, you know, et cetera.
The question I always have is who's getting paid for this information and why?
Great questions.
You know, somebody's trying to make money. One of the things is, as I was looking through this book, that I thought was really cool is the way that it's broken up into different segments. But at the end of each segment, there's a hall of shame for particularly egregious things that have happened medically over history. There's the Women's Health Hall of Shame, the Antidotes Hall of Shame, the Men's Health Hall of Shame, Weight Loss Hall of Shame, and it goes on from there, where you really do take on some of these things that are particularly egregious. Let's dig into some of the wrong ways to cure things. I found it fascinating that we once thought of mercury as a cure for a lot of ailments, and some people called it the king.
Right. Yeah, mercury, of course, something you generally want to avoid. But for about 400 years, from about the 16th through the 20th century, mercury was commonly found in medicine. It was called calomel, and it was claimed to cure a wide variety of sort of strange and unrelated ailments. So like things like melancholy or constipation or syphilis or influenza or even parasites. The reason why is that if you take calomel orally, it's a potent cathartic. So it's going to violently empty out your guts, basically. And since constipation was long associated with sickness, fixing that problem seemed to be like this really great idea for curing all sorts of other ailments. So what I think is interesting about mercury is it shows up with some of our famous people from American history as well. So Abraham Lincoln, before his presidency, you know, notoriously suffered from mood swings and headaches and constipation. So he started taking a product that was on the market in the middle part of the 19th century called blue mass pills. And blue mass pills were these small little pills about the size of a peppercorn, so pretty tiny, and they contained pure liquid mercury, as well as a few other things to kind of make it taste good, like rose water and sugar. And liquid mercury is rather poorly absorbed in your intestines, so it's really compounded to fit into these little pills, and that makes it release vapor forms inside of you. And so that's what Lincoln took, and he felt like he was getting worse. So it's good for him to kind of pay attention to that, but he realized that his behavior was getting more volatile. So he had these bouts of depression and rage and insomnia and so on, and those were probably caused by mercury toxicity in his system. Thankfully for the nation, he stopped using them right before he entered the White House, actually, which is kind of interesting.
Well, probably good for history and good for us that he did that. Let's take a break. I'd like to invite our audience to weigh in on what they think are some examples of quackery. Maybe they're in the book, maybe they're not. Maybe you'll get enough ideas to have a second volume. You never know. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We are talking about the book, Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything, written by Dr. Lydia King, M.D., and Nate Peterson. Nate is with us on the morning show this morning. You can be, too, at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We'll be right back. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on the morning show today. And my guest this hour is Nate Peterson, Oregon-based librarian, historian, freelance journalist, and UW alum. He is co-author of the book Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. We have a lot of people who want to join us by phone, and I want to get to those calls. But first of all, there are a couple of other compounds that we don't normally associate with good health that were used as treatments. For example, arsenic is something that we know now is something we don't want in our bodies. However, this was once used as a treatment. What were we using arsenic for?
Sure, arsenic. So that's a good one. So probably the best known arsenic medicine was called Fowler's Solution. That was created in 1786. That was 1% potassium arsenate with lavender flavoring. And that was claimed to cure syphilis, sleeping sickness, and malaria. And sometimes it was even applied directly to tumors because doctors knew that arsenic could dissolve skin tissue. But it was all show. It was no substance. Arsenic had this kind of funny thing about it. So when you take arsenic, it dilates the small capillaries in your face, which makes your face look kind of flushed. And people associated that for a long time with health, like this the flush or the bloom of health. But you don't actually, you know, end up feeling any better. And in fact, as you build up arsenic in your system, it starts causing some alarming symptoms of its own. Another few famous folks in history we know drank arsenic in the form of Fowler's Solution, including Karl Marx and Charles Darwin.
Interesting. The other one, and then we're going to go to calls because we've got a ton of them lined up, and some. I want to make sure our audience has a chance to ask some questions here. But radiation—that was the one that really that really struck me, or was one of them. I mean, people would purposely irradiate themselves or absorb materials that had radioactive properties. There were even spas that had radioactive baths. People were breathing in radon. It was thought that this was a health cure. Talk a little bit about the rage of radiation.
Yeah, everyone was super excited about radium when it was rather famously discovered by the Curies. And, you know, radium is interesting, and obviously it produces radioactivity and radiation, and that was not at all understood, you know, and folks were forced experimenting with that element. So the Pure Food and Drug Act passes in 1906, and that puts a lot of quackery out of business, but radium remains entirely unregulated because it's classified as a natural element rather than a drug. So quacks around the country began exploiting radium's sort of mysterious qualities, right, for their own gain. So one example of that is cosmetics. You know, going back to kind of what I said about arsenic, people associated, you know, the glow of health, right? Like, and you can kind of imagine where I'm going here, the glow of radiation.
You
like,
glow in the dark.
Right, exactly. You know, there was some great advertisements for cosmetics that you can find online still from the 1920s, where in Britain and France in particular, there was a whole lines of cosmetic products aimed at upper-class women that had radium included in it. Thankfully for everyone, radium has always been very difficult to obtain, very expensive, right? So they couldn't just totally load these things down with radium. Otherwise, you know, there would have been just a huge amount of cases of cancer. So it's relatively small amounts, but it's still, it makes this kind of laugh, sadly, today when you look at advertisements for radium and beauty and that kind of thing. You know, there's a great story we tell in the book about, I mean, it's a tragic story, but it's a great story too, about an industrialist named Evan Byers in 1927, who became a deep enthusiast of drinking Radithor, which was this sort of quack medicine that contained a couple microcurie of radium in every dose. And this guy would drink three bottles of the stuff every day. And, you know, after 4 years of daily use of that, he built up radiation levels in his body equivalent to having received several thousand x-rays, you know, just a huge amount. And it killed him. It killed him rather gruesomely. And his death, since he was kind of a famous guy, Evan Byers on the East Coast, his death led to a federal investigation into what was going on. His bones were deemed so radioactive that he had to be buried in a lead-lined coffin, which is kind of crazy to think about. And his death in turn kind of collapsed the market and radium as a quack medicine overnight as people started to wake up to the dangers of it.
Okay. Let's take some calls. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join us. The lines are full now. Try sending us an email or joining us on Facebook, and we'll be happy to post your comment or question. But let's go to the phones. We'll start in Madison, where Craig is with us. Craig, hello. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Hi there. Glad to speak with you. So I wanted to just mention a couple, I guess, quackery things with animal medication as well. I work in veterinary medicine. It's really interesting because a lot of the holistic veterinary or animal supplements, I should say, just actually contain a large amount of alcohol. So when they're given to the animal, people think they're seeing results, and actually it's just, you know, just slightly drunk. And I don't want to mention any products by name per se, but a lot of the herbal supplements you'll find have like an insane percentage of alcohol, and sometimes it's around like 40% alcohol.
Well, I'll have to check that out for the days when I happen to run out of vodka. Craig, thanks for that call. I think this hits on something. You know, we hear, we see stories, and it's been popular in film and on television and in books, the idea of this in the 19th century, this person going around the country with his decorated wagon and his patent medicine cure, and, you know, Dr. So-and-so's miracle cure for fill in the blank. And a lot of it was just liquor and didn't really do anything, but there was perhaps some psychosomatic properties going on. Is that the kind of thing? Do we still see that going on today with a lot of things that are being pitched on the internet?
Yeah, I think, you know, what you're talking about there is the powerful placebo effect, right? You know, and the notion that if you believe that what you're taking is helpful for you, you know, sometimes it can kick in some natural healing processes in your own body. And then you become convinced, of course, that the product that you're taking is the answer when it isn't. And the story I just told about Evan Byers, for example, he was drinking this Radithor because he thought it improved his vitality and his energy levels. And he'd had this long-running arm pain that he thought that drinking radium was helping with. And of course it wasn't, and in fact it was making his health worse, but he still strongly believed that, you know, that it led to drinking way more than he should have over time. And, you know, you brought up an interesting point too with Craig and the caller there about the medicine shows. That I think is one of my favorite parts of quackery history, these touring acts where folks would show up, especially out west here, you know, in town, and try to draw you in with a compelling monologue about the virtues of their Kickapoo Indian ointment, or, you know, something similar to that.
Right.
And we talk a lot about that in the book too, about how, of course, you know, the main thing in those products is alcohol. And that's what you were essentially buying and benefiting from, I guess, if you want to call it that. And we have a great story as well about snake oil and mint, you know, which is one of my favorite quacks is Clark Stanley, the first original snake oil salesman. And, you know, he, if we can just briefly tell this story anyway,
sure.
he shows up in a 1893 at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, and determined to make a name for himself, to make a bit of a show. He's competing with a lot of things going on at that, like the first electric kitchen on display, PBR, Pabst Ribbon, makes his debut there. So Clark Stanley shows up and he dresses up like a frontiersman, really showy style. You know, he gets up on a stage in front of this crowd. He reaches into a sack at his feet and he pulls out this rattlesnake, a live rattlesnake, you know, writhing, venomous rattlesnake, and he holds it up in front of the audience. And then he slits the snake open with his knife, tosses it into this vat of boiling water next to him, and that snake fat kind of boils up to the surface. He skims off that snake fat, tosses it into a jar, sells it to the crowd as Clark Stanley's snake oil and mint, right? And the funny part about that to me is that it turns out the folks at that fair in 1893 were the only people really over the years that actually got to have snake in their snake oil, because you pretty quickly figured out that, you know, rattlesnakes are dangerous and they're expensive. You know, there's not a whole lot of fat relative to having to find one and kill one, you know, that you're going to get from it. So he substitutes, he gets rid of the snake oil and substitutes it with beef fat. And still sells it, of course, as snake oil and mint, and makes a fortune. You know, over 24 years, no one picks up on it. Everyone relying again on that placebo effect and so on. And finally, the federal investigators seized a shipment of snake oil, did an analysis of the contents, found out that there wasn't actually snake at all in the snake oil, fined the guy a whopping $20. He had to pay a $20 fine. And then he walked off the pages of history, you know, pretty wealthy guy. So
yeah, he'd already made his money. Of course, today you don't need a wagon, a painted wagon and a horse to go around the country. You can just put on an infomercial on some television network desperate for an hour's worth of programming and reach your audience that way.
Absolutely.
Craig, thanks for your call. Let's go to Waupun next, where Justin is on the line. Justin, hello. Welcome to the morning show.
Yeah, thank you. I'm 68 right now, but when I was a child, any time you cut or scraped yourself before the Band-Aid went on, there was something called Mercurochrome that would be put on the cut. Do you recall that?
I remember Mercurochrome. The other, its sister or brother, depending on how you want to look at it, was methylate. But yeah, I remember getting that Mercurochrome. That was pretty popular.
Right.
I wonder if that had mercury in it.
That's what I was wondering, too.
That I'm not sure on offhand. I want to look that one up now.
Okay. Well, maybe our crack production team can look into this behind the scenes, and we'll get an answer to Justin's question. 800-642-1234. We have an email from Steve. Who writes, when I was growing up in the 1950s, I always had a cold shot every year, which my mother said kept away colds. We had two family doctors who gave them. Was this the normal practice? I have no idea what was in the shots. I just know I hated them. Were we giving cold and flu vaccine back in the 50s?
Huh, that's an interesting one, too. And again, that's not one I've heard about before. I'd be curious to learn a little bit more about a cold shot. You know, I wonder if it's...
I got a lot of shots in the 50s. I have a chronic tonsillitis. Why they didn't have my tonsils taken out, I don't know. But I used to get penicillin shots. And I tell you what, you do not want to get those. anyway, let's just leave that part of my history in the dark. Steve, thanks for your email. Again, we'll look into that. Maybe we'll find something out by the end of the hour. And clearly, Nate, you've got there's a lot more material out here. You could probably have volumes 2 and 3 all set up for you. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that we, in the book, for a lot of our chapters, we tend to focus on things that end by about the middle part of the 20th century. And, you know, sometimes we'll put in a modern update if it's something like, well, again, going back to radium, of course, today we use radiation as one of our main treatments of cancer. So we talk about that in the book too. But one of the interesting things as I've gone around sort of doing lectures and book signings and so on for quackery is hearing about all the stuff from about 1950 through present that we don't really cover in much detail in the book. But it's been fascinating to hear from folks like the listeners that are calling in today about some of these things from the last 60, 70 years or so that have been popular. So I'm making notes myself.
Okay, good. Ron is with us in Duluth, Minnesota. Ron, hello. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Hi. Wisconsin Public Radio airs a program.
We're losing you. Ron, you're in a bad cell. How about if you do this? Could you hang up and then call us back? Maybe you can get a better cell. I think I know where your question is going, and I really want to get that on the air. So maybe let's put Ron on hold and see if we can get a little better reception and then take him in just a moment. One of the things that comes up in your book that I really wanted to talk about is how our view of tobacco has changed over time, ranging from burning it to disinfect homes, using tobacco for its health benefits, to where we stand today. Smoking levels are at historic lows. Briefly, Nate, tell us about how our thoughts about this plant have changed over time.
Yeah, tobacco is one of those really interesting examples of where there's a great amount of enthusiasm for new discovery. So after European folks discovered, you know, that Native Americans have been using tobacco medicinally as well as ritually for hundreds, if not thousands of years, they got excited to kind of figure out what they could do with those tobacco leaves when they got back to Europe. And for a while, medical consensus landed on the smoke that's produced from tobacco as sort of the beneficial product of the plant. So more so than the leaves, they're saying the smoke that you produce when you're smoking is helpful. For example, in the 18th century, tobacco smoke was recommended for earaches. And the way that works is that you'd blow your secondhand smoke into your friend's ear so that your friend could be cured of an earache, right? Which is one of my favorite little cures. And then, of course, in the book, too, we talk about the sort of dreaded and infamous tobacco smoke enema, which was briefly all the rage in Britain in the 18th century as well, as a method of resuscitating people that seemed like they might have drowned in the Thames River in London there. You know, and sort of the horrifying thing is what happened to you next, right, is that you'd get this tobacco smoke enema in public, and people thought it would revive you, but it doesn't. The thought was that the tobacco smoke would warm you up and sort of stimulate respiration, and it doesn't do that at all. And eventually people realized that and stopped doing that. And then
we get that famous saying that I'm not going to repeat on the air.
That's exactly where we get that famous saying. Yes, that's exactly right. And,
wow.
You know, it took a long time, you know, all the way through the middle part, really, of the last century. Even physicians smoked in about the same ratio as the rest of the public. You know, a lot of people smoked cigarettes all the time. And so the tobacco industry had this last sort of foray where they wanted to bring in physician testimonials. It led to a really colorful ad campaign as the tobacco industry started to worry, you know, that people were kind of wising up to some of the negativity of smoking, the negative health benefits of smoking. They decided that they should get some physician testimonials to fight that. So there's a lot of great ads from the middle part of the last century, like things like more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Give your throat a vacation. Smoke a fresh cigarette. That's my favorite.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, of course, cigarettes were given to soldiers because it was thought that cigarettes enhanced alertness and they were beneficial. Smoke them if you got them.
Right.
And, you know, a lucky strike. So, you know, and that was the thought of the day. Now, in hindsight, you know, we look at that and think, gosh, you know, what was wrong with these people? But at the time, this was the common wisdom. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander next. Rich, hello. You're on the morning show.
Thank you. I grew up in Wisconsin. I'm now nearly three-quarters of a century old, but I remember in the 50s that codeine cough syrup was readily available as an OTC over-the-counter treatment, and then my parents would just go in on the shelf and pick off bottles of codeine cough syrup. Today, that's pretty strictly controlled by signature, and I wonder what your guest has to say about the history of a very strong compound like that in terms of the treatment of disease.
Rich, thanks for that. I know there's a lot in the book about opium and heroin and the related compounds. Codeine would certainly be in that group. What do you think about what Rich just had to say there?
Yeah, there's a chapter, as you say, on opiates. You know, there's opiates, like opium in particular, were used in a number of kind of interesting ways, in particular by folks that were hoping to have their children, you know, not make a fuss or not make, you know, not cry anymore. So things like Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup or Godfrey's cordial and so on, these were medicines that are quote unquote medicines that had opium in them that would help put your baby to sleep. Yeah, you know, that was one of the common uses.
Yeah, no doubt. Hey, the baby is fussy, give him some morphine, that'll take care of it. Wow.
Right. I mean, and it worked, quote unquote, right? I mean, it's effective at doing what they wanted it to do. The problem is everything else that goes with that, you know, and morphine, of course, is another example. Morphine, rather sadly, was commonly used as a painkiller, and a lot of Civil War veterans on both sides came out of that war addicted to morphine because it was used as they were trying to.
Well, and not just the Civil War, going all the way through World War One, and, you know, morphine was used as a painkiller in hospitals. It's still used as a painkiller in hospitals, but its use is a lot more tightly regulated. But a lot of addiction came out of treatment of war injuries.
Absolutely. Yeah, in fact, a really good example of that that we talk about in the book relates to cocaine. So John Pemberton, a Confederate lieutenant, injured in one of the last battles of the Civil War, gets this pretty bad saber wound to his chest. And as he's recovering, he becomes addicted to morphine. He starts to think about other ways to kind of help him get past that. And he was a pharmacist in his regular life, and he'd heard about this cocaine-laced drink that was all the rage in Europe, which is in and of itself is its great story, which we can maybe go into later, but called Vin Mariani. And so he decides to try to make an American, you know, homegrown alternative to that and creates Coca-Cola.
Which had cocaine in it at one time.
Famously, yep. And for quite a number of the early part of its production, the early years, Coca-Cola famously had cocaine. And of course, today it still has cocoa extract, so extract from the cocoa leaves to provide something of that taste. But the cocaine is, of course, removed today.
And, you know, well, there were a number of other patent medicines that became soft drinks that are still popular. Dr. Pepper, I remember you were supposed to drink it at 10, 2, and 4, and it would keep you regular. Not to be too indelicate about it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have full phone lines. I do hope our caller from Duluth can get back in. And if you can't, please send us an email, because I think you had a really great question for our guest. I'll try and bring it up myself if you don't get back with us. But we'll take more questions and we'll continue our conversation. And I want to hear about people drinking cocaine in Europe when we come back. Also, and I know you do too, we're talking with Nate Peterson, an Oregon-based librarian, historian, and freelance journalist. He is the co-author of the book we're talking about this hour, the title Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. More of our discussion in just a moment. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent today. We're talking in this hour about the book Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. Lydia King, Dr. Lydia King, MD, and Nate Peterson are the co-authors of this book. Nate is with us, and we're talking about some of these cures, but we're also taking your calls and getting your ideas about some things that, well, they probably didn't work out quite the way the advertising said that they would. And I think we've got a great example here from Doris in Altoona. So let's go there next. Doris, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you. I want to tell you a little story about Mom and a product called Geritol. My mom was a teetotaler. She didn't believe in any alcohol at all. But she went to show us one day what she had been taking, which she was swearing that gave her a lot more energy, little anxiety, and she felt so good. And someone took the bottle and said, well, Mom, this says it contains some alcohol. alcohol. Why, that wouldn't fit a teetotaler. And I remember she walked to the back door, pitched that bottle out into the frozen snow, shut the door, and said, well, that's it. And I'm wondering, did Geritol have alcohol?
And what do we know about Geritol besides the fact that Lawrence Welk made money peddling it for years?
Yeah, so I believe that Geritol was an alcohol-based tonic in the middle part of the last century. I think that was pretty commonly used. So if I recall, it had iron and B vitamins, and it was alcohol-based, though. So, yeah, that's absolutely right. And another example of a lot of these quack medicines that were essentially just alcohol. You know, that was the main thing that was in them.
Hmm. But there's nothing wrong with taking some B vitamins, though. I mean, there was probably something in there, but the alcohol was what it was riding on, and that probably produced the immediate euphoric effect.
Exactly, right.
Okay. Doris, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Scott, who is calling us from Madison. Scott, hello.
Hi there. My question is, within like the practice of Western medicine, we see a lot of impetus towards treatment in order to increase profit margins. At what point in time does a medical practice become quackery?
Yeah, where's the line from? Where's the line between quackery and not quackery, do you think?
Gosh, yeah, that's a hard question to answer. One of the real interesting things about is being able to speak with folks as we got on tour for this book is just hearing from medical professionals, from doctors and so on today, about their various opinions of things that are maybe were questionable, you know, that we're doing nowadays, or that are transitioning from something that would have been thought questionable to being something that seems really legitimate now. You know, there's just a headline, gosh, I think it was yesterday in the newspaper, about how you know, a complete ankle reconstruction used to be quackery, essentially used to be thought of as a quackery. Like, you couldn't actually do that and people would make money off of that. But like, now it's becoming a real thing. Or another example of kind of pushing the medical frontier. I've heard from a couple of physicians while we've been out talking to folks about this notion of the human biome being this whole new medical frontier that's just starting to be explored. And it's kind of changing the way physicians are even thinking about how the human body operates. And that, to me, is a super interesting thing. You know, and I think as that develops, there'll be a lot of repercussions and sort of modifications to current treatments that might consider that.
And haven't there been quite a few things that have kind of gone from being thought of as quackery or portrayed, I think maybe that's a better word, portrayed as quackery, which are now an accepted part of medicine. I'll give you an example. The clinic that I get my primary treatment from has several acupuncturists on staff. And at one time that was, oh my goodness, you're messing with acupuncture. That's just crazy. Chiropractic, a number of examples of things that, oh, you don't mess with those things. They don't do any good, blah, blah, blah. Well, now, okay, my insurance company pays for visits to the chiropractor. Didn't used to do that. You don't really deal with a lot of that in your book, but that certainly seems to be something we've seen over history.
Absolutely. Yeah, and those are great examples, right? You know, acupuncture and chiropractic work definitely used to be considered very fringe things to be doing. At least, of course, you know, acupuncture, we should put in the caveat that in China and other parts of Asia has a long and deep accepted
centuries
medical history. Right, you know, going way, way back. But in Western medicine, it was initially viewed as something kind of on the fringe.
Well, it was foreign. It was foreign.
Yeah, right. It's foreign, right. And just like you, you know, my insurance also covers acupuncturists, and I regularly visit one myself. And, you know, it's one of those things, too, that's still a little bit difficult for science to explain exactly how that works, you know, and I think what we're getting there. But it's, you know, it is quite effective for a number of things.
There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy, or something like that. Let's, Scott, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Jim in Barron next, because I think Jim might have an answer for the email question we had earlier about cold shots. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yes, the shot that was given is called a gamma globulin shot. And it was really popular in the 50s, especially during the episodes of polio. And you used to get those in the summer and towards fall. So that's what they were getting when they were getting the cold shot. The second thing is that mercurochrome and methylate has mercury as its base. And I believe it was banned in like 1991. And I remember using that as, you know, I'm a physician, and we actually used methylate to prep people for their surgery.
Oh yeah. Well, it was a major league disinfectant.
Yes, absolutely. So it did work, and I think in small amounts and putting it on a cut, I think it has some benefits. But of course, we look at things and say we can't because of the potential.
Right. Jim, thanks for the call and for giving us that pointer on the gamma globulin. So, see, our audience can answer questions for us. This is great.
That was fantastic. Yeah, thanks.
Another email here. This is from Zach in Sheboygan. How has it happened that we seem to be living in a new age of quackery? There are some relatively innocuous things like copper bracelets being hawked on television to alleviate aches and pains. Obviously, that's not going to do anything, but there are also extremes that can cause great harm, such as anti-vaccination sentiments or other things that can cause harm or lead people to abstain from effective treatments. How do these things continue to exist in an age where we have such rigorous scientific review and the availability of valid information?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, my personal take on that, and this is just, you know, my opinion on it, but my feeling is that we live in this age where formerly respected institutions have kind of fallen by the wayside, sort of culturally speaking. So, you know, even going back 50 years or so, the physician was seen in a community as sort of this you know, bedrock of the community, right? Someone whose wisdom and advice you'd inherently trust. Similarly, back then, you might feel the same about a newspaper. You know, the newspaper was this place of journalistic integrity, et cetera. I feel like a lot of those norms have gone by the wayside, and a lot of our belief in these institutions has disintegrated a bit over the last period of time, particularly through the rise of the internet and so on. People sort of looking things up themselves or catering their news to the news they want to be reading, right, or to the opinions they want to be viewing. So to me, that sort of fuels the modern quackery, you know, and the fact that it's just so easy, and there's kind of a disbelief or a cynicism now in our old institutions, you know, so it's easy for people to try to avoid those institutions if they want to, and to try to self-diagnose or figure out what's going on their own. That's you know, that's a fertile market for quackery to take place in, I think.
Yeah. Thanks, Zach, for sharing your email with us. Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Iola, and Bonnie is waiting to talk to us. Bonnie, hello. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. my question, he mentioned modern quackery, and I was just wondering if he had an opinion or if he has heard of people drinking colloidal silver as, you know, a health benefit. I know some people that have a machine that has silver rods, and it runs, you know, they pour water in it and then it runs, and then they make these jugs of water and then they drink like a teaspoon of this colloidal silver each day, thinking that it, since they've been having that, it's and I just was, you know, I've done some research. I think it turns people blue if you drink too much of it. And I was just wondering if that's a quackery that he has heard of, or, you know.
Yeah, colloidal would mean it's in suspension. Colloidal silver, Nate, are you familiar with that one?
I am. Yeah, actually, we have a whole chapter on gold, which has a rich history in quackery, but silver shows up a little bit too. So today it's used topically as an antimicrobial, but it has a long kind of reputation. So going way back, like alchemists used to connect silver with the mind and the moon, and that gave rise to the terms of like that we'd use for mental disorders, like lunatic and so on. And rich folks would ingest silver, but just by virtue of using silver, like silver cutlery, right? So silver spoons and silver forks and so on. And that would eventually, as your caller said, eventually sort of changes their skin color. It's one of the reasons that wealthy people have the nickname of blue bloods, going a little bit further back. And even more recently, going into the colloidal silver example, there was a fellow, a libertarian politician in Montana, Stan Jones. He ran for governor a couple times in the early part of the 2000s. And he drank a huge amount of colloidal silver preparing for Y2K. So if you remember when everyone was really concerned about the transition from 1999 to 2000 and all the havoc that was supposed to be unleashed on the world. So in preparation for that, Mr. Jones drank a huge amount of colloidal silver, and it permanently turned his skin a gray-blue color. So yes, that's absolutely right.
Hmm. Great. Bonnie, thanks for that call. Let's see, we've got another email. This is from Lou. There was a thing in Lone Rock, Wisconsin called the Uranium Tunnel, and Lou wants to know if you know anything about that. A little bit of background we dug up after the email came in. Apparently, Lone Rock resident Kenneth Crook opened his uranium tunnel in an old store building, which he'd lined with plastic sacks containing 2,500 pounds of low-grade uranium ore from Nevada. He offered treatments for $1 an hour. Patients went there for arthritis treatments, among other things. We touched on the use of radiation before. Here's an example from Wisconsin of somebody making a buck, getting people to expose themselves to uranium.
Wow, that's a great story. I didn't know about the uranium tunnel, but it does remind me of, you mentioned earlier, the radium spas that was all the rage for a little while. You know, and medical consensus for a little while is people were trying to figure out what to make of this new discovery of radium. Medical consensus briefly landed on radon, which is the gas produced by decomposing radium. So it landed on radon as the curative and life-giving property that people found in hot springs, like the hot springs in Arkansas and so on. Mm-hmm. And so that was recommended for a long time is that was why people thought it was a good idea to visit hot springs, was to be able to sort of soak in and breathe in that radon, you know, which is of course not the benefit of a hot spring, but you know, people even added radium to their water, you know, and maybe some of your folks that are calling in had in their homes going way back. There was a fad for a while of having radium water in the house. So kind of probably around the same time that uranium tunnel was being used in Wisconsin, you know, you'd have a uranium ore crock that would irradiate your water purposefully for you. And you're supposed to drink, you know, 7 glasses of water every day from that crock, which is, you know, 7 glasses is a great amount of water to drink just regularly, right? But if it's irradiated, that makes it a little bit bad.
Gosh, there's so many things we are not going to get to, which would be, I suppose, an encouragement for people to actually read your book and find out what's in it. What do you hope people learn from your history of wrong cures?
What do I hope people learn? I think it's important, and we've touched on this a bit today too, but I think it's just important to keep a critical eye, but also an open mind. You know, so a critical eye in the sense of evaluating who's making a claim, you know, especially one that you find online or through an infomercial or a website or some Instagram or whatever, but also to keep, you know, an open mind going forward too, to something like we brought up acupuncture earlier, which might have been easy to dismiss at one point, and now it's turning out to have quite a bit of a beneficial property to it. So, you know, you want to find that delicate balance, I think, between an open mind and a critical eye. And I hope that people get out of the book too, just kind of a laugh, you know, like it's a little bit of a morbid laugh looking back at our curious decisions throughout history, but also feeling like the sense of common humanity, you know, like again, like this idea that these are the same types of people as you and I, right? They just wanted to live longer and be healthier. And, you know, we're all willing to make curious decisions in that quest. And I think that connects us to these folks and makes it all, we're all part of the same, you know, picture, which I like.
So knowing what you do about the history of cures gone wrong, do you think 100 years or so, someone's going to write a book just like yours about modern medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And, you know, and hopefully I'll be alive to see it, but probably not. I think there's so much, it's just an always evolving area, right? And there's always really interesting things just from the callers and emails that we've had in today. I've got a few leads for myself to look into that I'm really intrigued by. And who knows what else is going to come up and what we'll look back on and laugh at in 100 years. I think there'll always be rife material. I think, you know, every 100 years at a minimum, people could churn out another book like this and cover all sorts of new things that we've been messing around with.
Okay, Nate Peterson, thank you so much for spending this hour with us today. I really appreciate it. Great book. I enjoyed reading it and appreciate our discussion today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you and with the listeners there in Wisconsin.
Nate Peterson is an Oregon-based librarian, historian, and freelance journalist and co-author of the book Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. This program is, let's see, who all was involved? Chris Molina was handling on-air production for this hour of the program today. John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. We had Dean Kinetter on as well. Stay tuned. More to come.